said best by Yogi Berra. It's hard to predict, especially the future. And this is especially true in physics. Predicting things, especially on a long time scale, is a no-win situation. Unless you happen to be right, which I don't know anyone who's been right on a 50-year time scale. Maybe Robert will be right. The problem is that there's always the pessimists. And the pessimists really get it. They really, really get it when they prognosticate about what's going to happen. Because we just love to make fun of how wrong they were. So if we go back roughly 50 years from today, we go back to a Dyson. And Dyson was famously pessimistic about understanding the strong interactions and said that the strong interactions wouldn't be understood for 100 years. So he was only off by 93 years or so. They were understood 7 years after he made that statement. If we go back 100 years, Lord Kelvin very famously said in the late 1890s that physics is done, all we have to do is measure things better and better. It's time for biology. Physics is done. And of course, that was a silly and actually poor Lord Kelvin. I mean, he got the thermometer named after him, but all these other things, just terrible. So Lord Kelvin also famously told us that X-rays will prove to be a hoax, that there's no future in radio, and that heavier-than-air flying machines will never be built. Okay. He also said that Darwin was wrong because the sun was only a few million years old. So I'm taking the lesson of Lord Kelvin to heart. Now, granted, it's the probability that anyone will either remember or take any note of what I might prognosticate is comparable to the tuning required for the cosmological constant problem. But nonetheless, just on a matter of principle, it certainly sounds like a bad idea to be pessimistic. Fortunately, optimists don't fare much better either. Let's go back to Hawking. In 1980, famously said that N equals 8 supergravity was going to be a theory of everything and that physics would be solved in 20 years. That was a bad thing to say. And of course, string theorists, starting in 1985, told us that the theory of everything was at hand, and soon we'd calculate everything, alpha, m electron over m muon, theta kabibo, and so on. And, you know, it's wonderful when you're starting a subject for things to be extremely optimistic, because that's what it takes to push things forward. I think it was a perfectly terrific attitude to have. The problem is that if we plot two curves, on the y-axis is the probability that string theory will predict m electron over m muon, theta kabibo, and so on. On the horizontal axis is time. And I'm plotting two things, the belief by string theorists, you know, the average string theorist, at least my assessment of the belief of the average string theorist, if I can put enough caveats to that statement so I don't piss everyone off, then this is what it looks like. Okay, around 85, euphoria. Okay, things are a little weird. There's millions of solutions, and we study conformal field theory for a long time, and it doesn't seem to be computing m electron over m muon, but probability of order 1. Okay? Then something happened in the duality revolution. The duality revolution was absolutely wonderful, but it was a booby prize. It was a consolation prize for something that people didn't want to happen. The hope was that you would push the theory in its supersymmetric limits into strongly coupled regions and uncover inconsistencies that would go some way to explaining why you throw out all those solutions and eventually find the one that looks like the standard model. That didn't happen. Instead, they're all the same theory. There was a big moduli space. They're all connected to each other, which is terrific, but it's a consolation prize. Well, if your goal in life is to predict these numbers, it's a consolation prize. So that probability, I think, in the mind of most string theorists, went down then. I don't know quite where it went down to. but then I think it's more or less gone down to a number comparable to the tuning for the cosmological constant, which is a non-trivial statement, thanks to our friends, some of them who are sitting right here, with the real convincing case that there's actually a big landscape of vacua out there. So this is the probability of string theorists. Honestly, wouldn't a string theorist who you talk to? The problem is, this is the belief of clueless popularizers and science journalists, is the top line, which unfortunately has not tracked the belief of practicing string theorists. This is a common phenomenon in academia. We all know that graduate students tend to be, you know, 5 years behind the times when they come in. They're interested in things that were interesting to us 5 years ago. Well, science journalists are sort of 10 years behind the times. So I think they've still yet to hit that. And that's not going to be fun when they hit it. So, okay, but even optimists don't do well. So much for general considerations. Me specifically, I don't do well. Okay, I'm generally an optimist, but I've had a bad track record. And in particular, exactly one year ago today, I burst into my office telling everyone in sight, "Red Sox win! Red Sox win! That's it! Bush is gone." Not necessarily rational, but there's some more than one person who believed that. And that was completely wrong, and that happened. That's the 1 year anniversary of that sad day. And many of my students blame me to this day for getting their hopes up. All right, so obviously, slightly seriously, the biggest danger of these very long-range predictions in science are, and especially in our field, is that in 50 years, the very framework of physics could be dramatically different. The biggest example is going from classical to quantum, where even the kinematics are different, the arena is different, the variables are different, everything is different. So that we may not even have the right language to ask the right question yet. In fact, I think many of us suspect that that a lot of the problems that we're confronting are because we're not quite asking the correct questions yet. So that our concerns now, and certainly the experiments we do now, and the LHC now, are tied to our concerns now, but it's quite likely that these concerns will look quaint in the light of what we might know in 50 years, and not very much comment will be made of it. On the other hand, it's possible that we'll see very, very important things. So here's something I'm imagining I might see 50 years after the LHC. By after the LHC, I'm imagining that for sure we have some discovery at the LHC. I don't know, by 2009, maybe there's a Nobel Prize in 2010. So let's call 2010 the date. So we're talking about 2060. On the 50-year anniversary of this amazing discovery, surely the most important, it's the general important thing for all of humanity, so it should be out there in the most important newspapers of the day. And I will certainly be reading the most important newspapers of the day. So here's what some headline might look like. By the way, at this point, I'll be 88 years old, and I'll definitely be living in California. So here it is. So in the California edition of the Waterloo Times, all the news that's fit to print, in October 28, 2060, there's a nice article on the LHC 50 years later. There's an article on Texas upset over outrageous Ottawa cow tax, with plans for a Dallas cow party. And of course, there's an irrelevant news about a vapid celebrity. Some things never change. Of course, what's happened in the intervening 50 years is that the intellectual downfall of America has allowed Canada to politely, but firmly, take over North America. So anyway, this article begins, "The Large Hadron Collider, which made its first major discovery exactly 50 years ago, came to be the most important and exciting experiment in the early science of the 21st century, revealing stunning new vistas in our quest to discover the fundamental laws of nature." That sounds great, but again, your frame of reference can change in 50 years. Of course, its impact was overshadowed by the first wave of alien invasions in 2017. Fortunately, our alien overlords are generous, kind, and all geniuses, largely obviating the need for us to continue doing science. and certainly obviating the need to talk about the LHC very much. So things can certainly change. All right. So let's start talking about the physics a little bit. Assuming that some of the questions that we think of as big questions will still be thought of as big questions, or at least indicating the road to big questions, here are, as far as I see, the big questions that many people see today. There's the problem of quantum gravity, the cosmological constant problem, and the hierarchy problem. The first one's a real, honest-to-goodness, dynamical problem. We don't know what happens in certain kinematic regions of our theory. We don't know what happens when you smash particles into each other at high energies, what happens at curvature singularities, and so on. The other two aren't problems like that, so they're not, in that sense, classic physics problems, but they are problems of naturalness, and the fine-tunings involved are so ridiculous as to make us suspect we're missing something very big. So that's why I list these problems, and in particular why I boxed the CC problem, because it has to do with everything. It has to do with quantum mechanics, it has to do with gravity, and it's numerically the biggest of all the problems. So that's certainly the one that whose solution I would pay the most to know. The hierarchy problem, I would say, is the least important of these three problems, but the dominant reason to expect to see something at the LHC. So why would someone work on the hierarchy problem if it's not as important as the other two? Well, here is at least my own big picture, circa when I got my PhD. Okay. My big picture was, and a very common big picture, that actually the problems, all three problems, are somehow intimately related to each other. And okay, there's some silly numerology, the classic well-known correspondence between the value of the energy scale in the universe today and the weak scale in the Planck scale. But more than that, something that made a big impression on me is that while in field theory you can consistently solve the hierarchy problem, but you can't solve the cosmological constant problem, in string theory it seemed like you have to solve them both together. And the reason was that every time anyone tried to break supersymmetry in string theory, you would get these runaway potentials. So string theory didn't even allow you to have a cosmological constant problem. It didn't give you a cosmological constant. It gave you potentials that ran away. So that there was no way in the framework of string theory to have some model that generated, that was non-supersymmetric, generated a hierarchy, but had a small cosmological constant. So that seemed to indicate to me that these problems are intimately related to each other. Okay? If they're intimately related to each other, it's possible that if you work on one, that you're actually saying something about the other. So this picture implied to me, and to many people, that there's going to be a deep solution to the cosmological constant, some unknown mechanism, something that would that would solve that problem. Very likely a natural solution to the hierarchy problem, but what? What natural solution to the hierarchy problem? And the reason it was worth thinking about it was, it had some importance not just in itself, but maybe it was tied up with all the other problems. And B, of course, we're going to have data, so we'd be able to test that aspect of it at least experimentally. So it's the combination of these things that seemed to make it something worth working on. And of course, there are many approaches to the hierarchy problem, starting with supersymmetry, with gauge coupling unification and dark matter. As very, very beautiful things that work. The other ones don't have a similarly striking thing that worked, but there's a number of nice ideas. There might be strong dynamics or what's the same, warp dimensions down around the TED scale. We might have some genuine kind of low-scale quantum gravity in large dimensions. And of course, there's exponentially large number of linear combinations of the above ideas. So there's just a zoo of possible approaches to the hierarchy problem. But two very big perturbations to just the zeroth order picture, at least I had in my own mind, happened since 2000. The two big perturbations are the discovery of the accelerating universe and the string landscape. That added to something which was a growing perturbation, all along that's been still growing the whole time, not as big as the other two, but in some sense more precise and more nagging, which is the persistent lack of any convincing evidence for new physics at the TEV scale. So if I were to just plot as a function of time the sort of night thoughts of a beyond the standard model model builder, we'd start back around 1980. So what I'm drawing here are sort of happy thoughts and at least ambivalent thoughts, strange thoughts, the thoughts that you try to put out of your head as you're trying to fall asleep. Okay? There are lots of happy thoughts right at the beginning because there are lots of very nice ideas, the ideas of supersymmetry, technicolor. There were natural solutions to the hierarchy problem. Already back in 1980, there were these little things. Well, the cosmological constant isn't really a little thing, because the problem was there already back then. But one could at least sort of psychologically ignore it for a while because it was all tied up with the intricacies of quantum gravity. Actually, before supersymmetry, the point of view that the cosmological constant is somehow tied up with quantum gravity was a more tenable one, because the divergence contributions to the vacuum energy really go all the way up to the Planck scale. And if they go up to the Planck scale, then it's reasonable, maybe, that something going on at the Planck scale might conspiratorially cancel it. In a supersymmetric theory, even that goes away, because, of course, the divergent contributions shut off above the supersymmetry breaking scale, which can be parametrically beneath the Planck scale. So you would now start having to talk about conspiracies between even conspiracies happening at a scale where there's no particular reason for anything to happen there. There's a reason for something happening at the Planck scale, but not at the supersymmetry breaking scale. However, there was still always the hope that lambda is zero for some deep reason, we put it aside. Already back in 1980, there was the problem that all of these theories would have predicted, very naively, that some of the conserved quantities, which are guaranteed to be conserved in the standard model as accidental symmetries, are no longer guaranteed to be conserved, and we should have seen large violations of flavor, CP, and so on. Some of those problems already existed in 1980. Not all of them, but some of them already did. That's why, beginning in 1980, there was such a field as beyond the standard model model building, because you had to figure out how to address these little problems. Now, let's move on. In 90, after the experiments at SLAC and LEP1, there was an additional reason to be happy. There was a picture of gauge coupling unification, which worked beautifully, at least in the context of supersymmetry. However, and the cosmological constant more or less didn't change. That was the same. But interestingly, while gaining that, this no beyond the standard model nagging thing grew a little bit. Okay? Because after all, LEP wasn't really built with the desire to measure the parameters of the standard model with great accuracy, which of course it did. But, you know, they wanted to discover something. And many theorists were telling them that they should discover something. If you look at the literature in supersymmetry model building in 1988, 1987, it's filled with signatures of 30 GeV neutralinos and 60 GeV gluinos. And people weren't saying this because it was wishful thinking. It happens. It's reasonable. So it was already a little troubling that nothing showed up then. But still, nothing to get particularly been out of shape about, perhaps. Now, as we continued to going, in the late 90s, there were more ideas for what might be happening at the weak scale, more reason to be happy, more combinations of things, ingredients to be able to throw together and write papers. But more reasons to be distressed. The accelerating universe now turned this little lambda into a very big lambda question. And after LEP2 in particular, post-LEP2, the no beyond the standard model grew, I think, by another significant factor. And meanwhile, completely outside the line of this development, theoretically, was a completely different idea, the idea that there might be this enormous landscape of vacuum. So these are just huge perturbations, and the huge perturbations really started relatively recently in the history of the development of these ideas. So before talking about 50 years from now, I really want to emphasize that our predicament right now in 2005 could not possibly be more puzzling, more tense, and more exciting. Because we have these conflicting clues from experiment. Okay? What do these clues mean? What direction do they push us in? And I think that the implication for what even the shape of physics is in 50 years are possibly profound. I actually wrote likely profound there, but they may not be. Okay? But they are possibly very profound implications for what physics will even be about in 50 years. The problem is that the clues don't come attached with little tags that say, I'm important, pay attention to me. That one isn't very important. Okay, this is the important clue. And the hints from data are not so sharp as to completely tell us, okay, completely abandon this idea, hold on to this other idea. Okay? There's a vague picture there. You can read this vague picture in a number of ways. You can read the vague picture that there's no hints for physics beyond the Standard Model, for example. It's just telling us that, it's just really around the corner, you're giving up too early, you know, keep your pants on, it's okay. There's actually a very beautiful mechanism that if you thought hard enough, you would discover, and that explains why you didn't see any of these things, so it's okay. Just hold on, don't jump ship, and your decades of thought along these lines will be duly rewarded when the LHC discovers these 150 new particles, and you'll go out and measure all their properties and drink champagne if you drink. Okay. Or you can read it like, geez, this persistent lack of new signals is maybe telling us something. Maybe there isn't a lot out there. Okay. And if the data was a factor of 100 better in each one of these experiments, we'd know the answer one way or the other. It isn't. And so we are left in a situation where we have to try to glean even a moral lesson from the data that we have so far. Now, of course, that's when science is most exciting. That's when science is most exciting because it's when choices about what you take seriously and what you don't make bigger bifurcatory differences than any innate ability, any innate talent. If you bet on the right horse, you're likely to make progress. So the question is, what is the right horse to bet on? And again, in such times, there's always a tension between choosing a conservative solution to a problem and choosing a radical solution to a problem. In the mythology of physics, we love the radical solutions. But it's worth remembering that the best physics is always a combination of both of them. After all, the extreme of the radical direction, which, by the way, since I'm in Canada, like most sensible countries, radical is red and conservative is blue. Okay. So in the extreme radical direction are crackpots. Okay? The extreme radical says everything before me is wrong. Okay? That's the extreme radical statement. On the other hand, in the other direction are extreme conservative curmudgeons. The curmudgeons say everything after me is wrong. Okay, everything you idiots are doing now, it's all bullshit. Okay, we invented the Standard Model. We knew what we were doing. You guys are all fucking around. You suck. Okay. And of course, good physics is always in between. Okay. It's always in between. Since Ptolemy, Ptolemy was the last time everything before someone was wrong. I guess Copernicus. Okay. Since Copernicus, that's never happened. It has never happened that some direction in progress in our field has been entirely, completely wrong. Okay? So that means that the extreme radical position is unlikely to be correct. The extreme conservative position is obviously unlikely to be correct. And the interesting question is, how much of each? For what questions should we give conservative answers? What questions deserve radical ones? And it isn't obvious. It's hard to know ahead of time. But I can make the following table, and then I'm going to go to the blackboard, and we're going to spend some time talking about this table and just discussing it. So at least in the framework of the questions that I laid out, at least here's the way of thinking about what's going on. Here's the cosmological constant and the hierarchy problem. There's quantum gravity. And I've just drawn a little table, the lambda and the hierarchy. And the boxes are whether the solution to the cosmological constant problem is natural, whether it satisfies the rules of naturalness. Or is it environmental? Is it an anthropic solution like perhaps on the landscape? Or is it something else? Similarly for the hierarchy problem. And the final box is quantum gravity important, not in itself, which of course you may think it is, but specifically in addressing these problems. In other words, are these problems sensitive to the ultraviolet properties of gravity in an important way? Now, my guess in 97, I told you. My guess now, as you probably know, is this. My guess now is that the cosmological constant is probably environmental. And the quantum gravity is actually not important. While string theory gives us a huge landscape of vacua, at least at present it isn't in any way clear that that enormous landscape is somehow tied up in detail to the real detailed ultraviolet properties of the theory. And lots of theories can give you huge numbers of vacua. So I don't see a detailed connection of the sort of miracle that people wanted in UVIR connections and so on for the cosmological constant problem. For the hierarchy problem, I don't know. I think it's basically equally likely that it could be either. And I honestly vacillate day to day. But also I believe that the short distance properties of gravity are irrelevant. So at least my view is that there's a real clean separation between ultraviolet physics and this dirt of the infrared world, which is just not all that important in the end. Okay? So this answer, from the point of view of me in 97, is crushingly disappointing. I wanted the solutions to these problems to be deep and important and teach us about the fundamental properties of the world. It may be teaching us something really spectacular, that there's this huge landscape out there, but it simultaneously means that there's just no direct correlation between these things and those things at all. So that's disappointing. But it could be true, and in fact, at the moment, I think it's the most likely possibility. But what I want to talk about now for a few minutes is that the LHC and other ongoing and planned experiments can start filling out this table. And we may be much more confident by 2060 in what's going on. Now, when we start filling out this table, there are a whole lot of combinatorial possibilities of where different check marks go. So I'm going to do that on the blackboard, and we will discuss it. How long do I have, by the way? Oh, great. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is go through a variety of scenarios for what might happen and what we might know in 50 years. And despite the early warnings about projecting 50 years in the future, there is, at least in the recent history of the field, a slowing down, at least on the experimental time scale, for things to happen. So, you know, maybe we'll have a linear collider in 2065. But it'll certainly take a time scale of, let's say, 20 years for the LHC to give us everything it can. So let's start talking about that. So, let me draw this picture again. Okay, and first I just want to start filling out some of these boxes from a theoretical point of view. Okay. Let's start with lambdas, most important one. Let's start with that possibility. So it's possible that in fact there is a natural solution to the cosmological constant problem. By which I mean that since the value of the cosmological constant is 10 to the minus 3 electron volt to the fourth, that perhaps there's really some low cutoff in the theory of order, 10 to the minus 3 electron volt, and that at least the quantum contributions to the vacuum energy are naturally of that scale. Now, since this is a much lower energy scale, it's a millimeter, this cutoff should only be there for gravity, and this leads to the idea that maybe there's some sort of form factor associated in the coupling of gravity to matter, which just shuts off the cosmological constant when things get off shell by more than a millimeter. Now, the idea that a natural solution to the cosmological constant problem should imply some new gravitational physics at a millimeter is a completely obvious one. What's not obvious is that this is sensible. It's not obvious that it's sensible, certainly in a full theory. No full theory we've ever seen looks like that. It goes very much against any spirit of unification between gravity and the other interactions. Because gravity has got to be this huge, giant millimeter fluff ball, while everything else is point-like down to the TeV scale. So in a sense, it's very conservative, because it says things are natural and they're fine, but it forces you into an incredibly radical revision of your picture of gravity. Now, what Raman Sundaram has done is show that at least this picture is plausibly consistent as an effective theory, which in itself isn't completely obvious. But certainly there's no full picture for where this might come from. However, what's great about this idea is that it at least has some qualitative prediction. The qualitative prediction is that gravity should shut off at short distances. Short distances compared to around a millimeter. And that's what, as I'm sure you heard here, the Adelberger group is looking at right now. Okay, so much for the natural possibility. So let me just say right away, suppose we become convinced in the next 2 years that gravity shuts off beneath a millimeter. Okay, then the game is over for me. I put a check mark here, and I go back to thinking about natural theories. Okay, if even the cosmological constant problem has a natural solution, then I at least am completely convinced that that naturalness is an incredibly good guide. It would be such an incredibly good guide that if you believed in it, it would force you into this, on the face of it, completely ludicrous picture for what gravity should look like. And if that supposition led you to that correct, even qualitative conclusion, I would trust it to the end of my days. Okay? So a huge amount rides on these experiments and their interpretation, obviously. Okay. This one is well known. It's the Weinberg argument for the cosmological constant in theories with a huge landscape of vacua. What about some others? Well, others can be even less developed than these ideas. And some of them are. The other is, I think, what almost everyone, I think the other is what I would have put the check mark in 97. The other is that it's all deep. Okay. So deep one is that there is some mysterious UV-IR connection which somehow gives you an exact cancellation between the ultraviolet and infrared contributions to the vacuum energy. Or that just that way of breaking up the calculation is really stupid, and there's a way of looking at it where the answer is just obviously small. The problem is it used to be obviously zero, and now we have to make it obviously small. Okay. Deep two is, to my mind, much, much more interesting, which is the idea that somehow we just have gravity wrong in the IR. And that's a very attractive idea. But again, it's challenging enough to modify gravity in the IR in a way that isn't in contradiction with experiment, never mind that has something concrete to say about the cosmological constant problem. And while it's very interesting to play this game, there's something about it that it still smells wrong, to me at least, which is that I would somehow hope that the modification of gravity in the IR is tied up in some fundamental way with the properties of gravity, perhaps in a cosmological setting, rather than the properties of some fields that you add to the theory or some brain configuration that you choose to study and so on. That's just a personal aesthetic argument. Okay, so between the three of these, I've already told you my own view. My own view is that that is in the radical conservative direction, too radical. Certainly this, well, this isn't even worth talking about because it's not even concrete enough to say anything about. This could be right, but in the current incarnations, it just feels too engineered. And again, doesn't concretely say anything about the cosmological constant problem yet. Whereas this has, to my mind, just the right combination of conservative and radical. It's very conservative in saying what's making the universe accelerate is vacuum energy. It's a cosmological constant. That's what it looks like it is. We don't have to invent, say, that everything is wrong, that the sort of obvious implications of GR are wrong, but we need an additional big ingredient of a sort that we've seen before in the history of our subject. Yes.
The comment is that I think that the cosmological constant problem is really a problem of when you try to combine quantum mechanics and gravity. At the classical level, there is no problem. Because if you take general relativity at the classical level, then...
There's just as much a problem classically as quantum mechanically. Classically, there's a parameter lambda in the theory. Lambda's still got to be 10 to the minus 120.
No, because classically, you don't have the Planck scale. So classically, you have G Newton and lambda, and there is no hierarchy whatsoever. There is only a problem once you need to do with Planck's constant.
Of course, but
so from the classical,
I understand that, but there is still a question. Let me say it like this: there's still a well-defined scale where, let's say, the interactions, the gravitational interactions between particles become comparable to, let's say, the electromagnetic interactions. Okay. Even classically, there is such a well-defined scale. After all, before Planck's system of units, there was Johnston's system of units, which is the same as Planck's system up to factors of alpha, because he used E rather than H. So they're just different by factors of alpha. Okay? So there is such a thing as a Planck scale. It's a little different from the Planck scale. It's a scale where electromagnetism and gravity catch up with each other. So there is such a well-defined short-distance scale. There is a long-distance scale, the curvature of the universe, and even classically, there's a question of why those things are so different from each other. But I agree the part that if we knew how to control the quantum corrections, we would have would be in a lot better shape. Yeah. No. Only insofar. Sorry. Only because I'm. Only because I'm. Only because, in the way of John, I'm trying to tie it to naturalness. Okay. So naturalness would lead you to predict that there is some low-scale cutoff beyond which we don't know things, and that the actual vacuum energy is. The actual thing that ends up appearing in what you would call a distance is bigger than a millimeter, the vacuum energy, is actually of order a millimeter to the fourth. Whereas if we're modifying gravity in the IR, as you know very well, the whole idea is that somehow the vacuum energy is still the particle physics scale, it's still TV to the fourth. So it's simply because naturalness would lead you to a prediction for a scale at which something should happen, which is at about a millimeter. Whereas the other idea doesn't. The other idea would let it happen at Hubble, or even perhaps larger scales. So that is the only reason. I mean, you might think it's an artificial distinction, but for example, if we discover that it's gravity modified in the IR that solves the cosmological constant problem, that wouldn't necessarily tell me anything about what to think about naturalness necessarily. Whereas if we discover that there's a natural solution to the CC problem, I would be completely convinced that there's a natural solution to the hierarchy problem as well. Yeah. Oh, obviously you can't put standard form factors. It doesn't make any sense. That's one of many reasons this idea is an idea for an idea. Okay, so. Yes, that's right, and that's what Raman worked very hard to make. Yeah, okay. Uh-huh. See,
so that's another way of solving. We don't need zero quantum. We don't even need it to accelerate the universe because it's possible.
So let me just say this one comment on things related to that. The uncalculability of the quantum corrections to the vacuum energy, their divergence and so on, is often used as some hint that maybe we're interpreting it wrong, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's a complete red herring. It's a complete red herring because there are classes of theories, supersymmetric theories, where it's calculable. You break supersymmetry, it's calculable, and you can calculate that the vacuum energy is not zero. Oh no, I can give you a very simple supersymmetric theory which breaks supersymmetry and you can calculate the vacuum energy and it's not zero. It's not infinity, it's not zero, it's a number. And it's cut off by the scale of supersymmetry break, and you're done. No, we haven't. But I'm saying that the presence of a little theoretical laboratory where you see that this issue of the ultraviolet sensitivity is a red herring makes it relatively convincing to me that the issue is a red herring. It may not be convincing to you. But it's convincing to me. Let me say one last thing about the environmental solution, which is that it has a flavor that that the other ones do not, at least not in an obvious way. It has the flavor that it has the potential to link the solution of the cosmological constant problem to the rest of physics. Something that many people have wanted, and many people have suspected or hoped in the back of their minds, is that whatever solves the cosmological constant problem might have a lot to do with the rest of particle physics, for example. Okay? But none of these ideas, none of the other ideas, none of them certainly have that flavor. If the graviton is composite of the millimeter, it doesn't seem to matter much whether you had three generations or two generations, or if it was 3-2-1 or something else. Or if you're modifying gravity in the infrared and you live on a brain or in some other way, it again doesn't seem to be too correlated with the structure of particle physics. Whereas in the environmental solution, it's possible that only in the regions of the landscape where that only in some regions of the landscape you get to get enough vacua so that you can find vacuum energies that are small enough in order to allow structure to form. And therefore, the presence of structure formation can act as a sort of big preselector on regions of the landscape that you might be able to end up in. So very concretely, there might be places where electroweak symmetry is broken by technicolor, and some places where it's broken because there's supersymmetry, and some places where it's fine-tuned and broken. But it may be that the regions where it looks like technicolor, you count, and there's only 10 to the 50 vacua there. And if there's 10 to the 50 vacua, you'll never be able to find one with a small enough vacuum energy to make structure. So the solution of the CC problem tells you that from the point of view of particle physics, something that looks totally natural might just have to be thrown out for other reasons. So of course, we don't know enough, but it's at least a hint. It's at least a possible connection. It doesn't completely decouple from the rest of physics in a way that the other solutions, at least to me, have a flavor of decoupling. All right. So let's also go through the Higgs mass. So for example, natural we know. Okay. Natural theories, it could be any one of these theories. It could be low energy supersymmetry, technicolor, whatever else. If it's environmental, well, the first sort of non-trivial statement is that it can be environmental. There is an environmental argument for the weak scale. Didn't have to be. There is one. The weak scale can't be very different than what it is for a similar gross environmental feature as the vacuum energy. If vacuum energy was too big, the universe would be empty of structure. If the Higgs mass was just bigger by a factor of 2 or 3 than what it is, the universe would be empty of atoms. And again, impossible to make interesting structure. And so, naively, there was always a strike against that, and again, in my mind, is that if it's that picture, it naively seems to suggest that you just see just the standard model. Just the standard model is good enough to accommodate that picture. And yet, but what about unification and what about dark matter? Weren't these things that were hints that we're on the right track? But in the last year and a half or so, there are other possibilities, alternatives to just the standard model, and I won't talk about them a lot here, but ideas like Split-Suzy or some very minimal models of dark matter and unification. Which preserve this, but have an environmental explanation for why the Higgs is light. And they do so in a way that now naturally explains why we haven't seen evidence for new physics. And the reason is that in all of these models, there are new particles near the TeV scale. They make up weak scale thermodynamic dark matter, but they're all fermions. All the new particles are fermions. And if you only have fermions as the new particles, it's impossible to write down the normalizable interactions between them and the standard model fields. So that's a very good reason why we haven't seen big effects due to them. The problem in all the other theories, like in supersymmetry, you have scalars, and there's lots of renormalizable interactions you can write down. And you have to worry that they're too big, and you've got to worry about them. But if there's only fermions, there are no new renormalizable interactions. And there's some of them have very interesting experimental signals, but anyway, I'm just categorizing things for now. So, but just to say one last thing about them, so already in 97, this environmental argument for the weak scale existed, but in my mind, there was always a tension between these two things, okay? And these models resolve that tension. You get to have the environmental solution while still explaining why there's no, you get to have the environmental solution, have unification in dark matter, but explain why you haven't seen any evidence for new physics. Now, I just want to say a few trivial things about other here. In fact, in thinking about other, I went back to some of my notes back from late 97 or so, just as I was starting at Slack, and I noticed to my delight something that I'd forgotten about that I'd thought of, which is actually a little pre-version of the landscape. One model I considered was that there's 10 to the 32 copies of the standard model. And if there's 10 to the 32 copies of the standard model, then accidentally one of them will have a light Higgs mass. And the one that accidentally has a light Higgs mass will also be the lightest of everything, so there's a good reason why everything in the universe would end up in that one. And we would see that we are that one. Okay? So that was an interesting thought. The problem is that if you have 10 to the 32 copies of the standard model and you couple them all to the same gravity, that there's an enormous renormalization of the Planck constant. And so the Planck scale would actually be just this n times the cutoff squared of the theory. So if you're going to bring the cutoff all the way down to a TeV, you're just moving the fine-tuning from the Higgs fine-tuning to a fine-tuning to keep the Planck scale where it is. So a natural theory like this would have 10 to the 32 copies of the standard model and a cutoff at a TeV, a low cutoff at a TeV. So this didn't work. But maybe something, maybe if you play around with gravity, you can make something like that work. And another idea that many people have talked about, but no one knows how to make work, is that we fret over these naturalness problems, and the question is, why is the system so close to a phase transition? When there's a natural scale of order the cutoff, why is it that the mass of the scalar is so close to a scale at which there would be a phase transition? Well, there are analogous phenomenon when you walk on the beach. When you walk along a beach, you notice that all the sand dunes tend to be at almost the same angle. And this is because if you drop sand and you start building up a sand pile, the sand pile builds up to a certain critical angle. And it stops at a critical angle such that any amount of extra sand that you drop on it causes an avalanche and takes it back to the same angle. So the system organizes itself to be right on the verge of a phase transition. Any tiny perturbation would cause a phase transition, but it's self-organized in a way that it keeps it. If we could figure out some way of realizing an idea like this in field theory, that would be great. But there's no concrete idea. So maybe there is something else going on that we haven't thought of yet. Yeah? Yeah. No, but I'm saying it doesn't solve. What I'm saying is that the idea behind that idea was to keep the cutoff near the Planck scale and explain why there's no tuning for the Higgs mass. No, but then the problem was that by the time you push the cutoff to a TeV, you're not solving any problem anymore. You don't need all of this. Oh, no, I know. But I'm saying that here the idea was to solve the hierarchy problem like this, and it doesn't work because you have to bring the cutoff down to a TeV. But minimally, so you can do it by pushing the tuning down to a tuning for the Planck scale. But maybe you can do something about, I mean, at least changes the nature of the problem, but it doesn't completely solve it, okay? I just mentioned it because it has, it sort of pre, anthropic feel to it anyway. Anyway. Okay. So that's a kind of menu of possible things. And now let me just quickly say what it is that the LHC might tell us, the LHC and some other experiments. So if the LHC sees nothing, first of all, let's go up it now. If the LHC sees absolutely nothing, not even a standard model Higgs, absolutely nothing, then we are deep in other territory. Okay? The headline in the Waterloo Times would be that the experiments of the LHC were the last nail in the coffin of quantum mechanics and gave the first evidence that unitarity is violated in nature. Without a standard model Higgs, no standard model Higgs or nothing up to energies. Now, we'd really need something maybe with twice the LHC energy to really be able to firmly convince it, but people at the LHC talk about going to twice the LHC energy. So eventually, by the time the LHC was done, you could just have absolute proof that quantum mechanics is wrong. Okay? That has probability less than the tuning for the cosmological constant, but yes. No, there isn't. Not without breaking quantum mechanics. Absolutely. I'll stick to it forever. If we don't see anything at the LHC, and I really mean if we go up to 3-4 TeV, and we don't see nothing of any sort. Sorry? So you'd have to just see perturbative scattering to energies far above. No resonance, precisely. No, nothing. No strong coupling of any sort, then quantum mechanics is wrong. Now, there's no way that's going to happen, but it is a possibility. All right. I mean, we can also like spontaneously combust, and I can tunnel through the wall. So you know, of course, all those things assume quantum mechanics. So never mind. It's even less likely than that, I think. Okay. Now, second, suppose we see only the Higgs. Only the Higgs, just boring standard model Higgs, I don't know, at 125 GeV. Only the Higgs and nothing else. This is the most interesting, well, the most difficult to think about case. Not only because of depression. But for physics reasons. The problem is it's very hard to interpret this. There's three interpretations. One of them is that there is only the Higgs, only up, all the way up to the Planck scale. Or up to very, very, very high energy scales. Okay. That's the case. If that were the case, we would be able to put this box firmly in the natural, in the unnatural category. And again, to my mind, if you see that even this dinky problem is unnatural, then in my mind, the big check mark goes there as well. They're not. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So in my mind, there's a big correlation between a check mark there and a check mark there. If there's one here, there's one there. The problem is that we are not going to know that there's the Higgs and nothing else all the way up to the Planck scale. And in fact, just at the LHC, if we see the Higgs and nothing else, we'll see evidence for some kind of fine-tuning at about a part in 10 to the 3. Okay? You see nothing at LHC with the Higgs and nothing else, there's a tuning of about a part in 10 to the 3. Then the debates begin. Is a part in 10 to the 3 bad? Is it okay? People will say that the moon eclipses the sun. Exactly. That's a complete accident. That's a tuning of about a part in 10 to the 3. That didn't have to happen. So let's say, oh, we've seen this happen before in nature. These little kind of tunings sort of happen. So maybe it isn't that there was a Higgs and nothing else all the way up to the Planck scale. Maybe there was just, there were the superpartners out there just too heavy to be made. There's a natural theory, but too heavy, just too heavy. We needed the SSC, damn it. But we just missed them with the LHC. Granted, these people wouldn't be standing on very firm ground, okay? But it's just true that, you know, when you're dealing with this sort of this level of a problem, it isn't completely obvious what to make of it. Okay? Now, and so one, so that's another possibility, and a final possibility is that there it isn't a natural theory; it's an unnatural theory. There are other particles out there, and at the TeV scale, they're even there. They give you dark matter. They give you unification. But you miss them. Okay? And that is a real possibility. The reason is that the particles that are going to give you dark matter just have to be weakly interacting, and it's possible that the LHC will miss weakly interacting particles that are up at 1 TeV. That's problematic. Fortunately, there are other experiments that could give us a handle that there is something going on at the TeV scale. Okay? Still rare process experiments, and specifically the electric dipole moment of the electron. If this new physics happens to have CP violation, this is a very, very important experiment because it's going to push current limits by a factor of 1,000 already before the LHC turns on, or right around when it's turning on by 2007. Okay? This is an amazing, really exciting thing. There's a number of groups in the world doing it. Specifically, Dave DeMille's group at Yale is going to improve the limit by a factor of 10 to the 2 by 2007. And even in these unnatural theories, even in these theories where the effects of the new particles are much more shielded from the standard model than standard natural theories, they should show up. So there's a conceivable scenario where the LHC sees the Higgs and nothing else, but you measure an EDM. If you measure an EDM, then you know for a fact that there is some new physics happening at around the TeV scale, and that you may have just missed it at the LHC. That's critical for being able to decide whether to continue or not, okay, and how to continue, and the sort of machine to build to continue. Okay, I'm just going to just be a few more minutes. The third possibility is that we see the Higgs and a few other particles. And depending on the kind of particles that we see, this could really shift us in the unnatural direction. For instance, in Split Susy, we might make a gluino. It's a fermion, so it's going to be down there at the TeV scale. And this gluino decays to a quark via virtual squark, and maybe down to the photino or something. And the important point is that because these things are so very heavy, the lifetime for the gluino is long. So this leads to a variety of very striking signals at the LHC. You would see that you're producing a strongly interacting particle that either travels some distance before it decays inside the detector, or perhaps even travels so far that it barrels through the detector. And it can even stop in the detector and decay inside the detector and do all sorts of interesting things. If you see that, paradoxically, more than if we just see the Higgs and nothing else, if we see that, we can be much more confident that the theory is unnatural, because we'll have many, many indirect handles on the existence of this much, much higher scale where the theory becomes supersymmetric. If you know that there's a much, much higher scale, and yet the Higgs is down at 125 GeV, you know that the tuning is much worse than 10 to the minus 3. The tuning might be 10 to the minus 6, or 10 to the minus 10, or 10 to the minus 20. And then I think it starts becoming more difficult to imagine that this is sort of on the borderline of being natural. So it's possible that we could get a check mark there. That is at least possible. Okay. And of course, finally, it's possible that we'll see a natural theory. That's the possibility that we've been thinking about for a long time. And if we see a natural theory, that would be great. But one thing it would leave us still in the dark about is the cosmological constant. And what could happen is that we'll see a natural theory, we'll see all these super partners, we'll go, we'll measure all their masses, we'll run things up to the Planck scale, we'll do all these wonderful things, and it'll just be like adding more parameters to the standard model. We'll discover their supersymmetry, that's terrific, but it would leave us in the dark as to lambda. So it's possible, if we see a natural theory, that it could delay this period of agony dealing with these issues by 30 years while we have fun building the new standard model that then all these same questions will be asked about in 30 years. Okay, so, and as I mentioned, there are two very critical experiments in other than the LHC. One of them are the short-range gravity experiments. If we see any indication of gravity shutting off beneath a millimeter, or solid indication that shuts off beneath a millimeter, that's revolutionary. It's a big deal. The other one is, of course, the measurement of W. If W is not equal to minus one, I think that's a big trouble for the, in my mind, it's a big trouble for the environmental argument for the cosmological constant. Okay, so much for what might happen 30, 50 years after the LHC. Let me just end with, I think, a more important comment. 2 years before the LHC, what should we be doing? By we, and people who care a lot about care a lot about this machine and what's going on. What we've been doing for a long time is building more and more interesting models for TEV scale physics. But I think that today, the n plus second variation on the n plus first model of electroweak symmetry breaking is unlikely to be very interesting unless it gives rise to really qualitatively new signals that we haven't thought of looking before, simply because we're going to know very soon what the right answer is. But there is a very critical question, which has been largely unexplored, which is the LHC inverse problem. How do we figure out what the right model is once we have signals for new physics from the LHC? How do we start from some signatures that we've measured in LHC signature space and construct this inverse map back to model space and figure out what the model is that corresponds to those set of signals? This is a non-trivial problem. It's not grunt work, and it needs ideas. And again, not much work has been done on it. So. Associated with this, I'd like to invite all of you to participate in the LHC Winter Olympics this year, to be held at CERN from February 9th through 10th. The idea of these meetings is to ramp up to getting more and more theorists of various stripes involved in trying to reconstruct models from toy sets of signals that have been generated. And in the first meeting that we had back in July, we were still at a fairly elementary level. In this meeting, things are reasonably professional. We've generated three sets of black boxes, one by the group at Michigan, one by Washington, and one by our group at Harvard. A lot of the standard model backgrounds have been generated. They've been passed through detector simulators so that the data you get is very similar to the data that you might actually see. And some important work has been done by a group of students at Harvard that have developed a very user-friendly Mathematica package that allows anyone, and I mean anyone, as in me, as in really anyone, to be able to, in real time, play with data, make plots, make histograms. It's removed the big barrier to being able to play with these things. And this is all available. They've made it available. It's available on the LHC Olympics website, and I think this thing should be fun. So I want to end. I didn't say what I thought would happen in 50 years, but of course, as Pauli said, only those who wager can win. So let me make a prediction. My prediction is that in 50 years, the LHC will be seen to have put the last nail in the coffin of the monovac theories. The landscape will be with us to stay, and the right mix of radical and conservative ideas will have been utilized, but the implications of all of this will likely continue to be mysterious, although possibly less so than today. Or, but it's not as bad as you think. Or there's really some sense in which gravity is modified in the IR in some subtle way. And not in a way that's sort of engineered, but in a way that's inevitably tied with the UV properties of the theory, perhaps because we live in a cosmological space rather than in flat space. And I think if this ends up being true, it'll be much more subtle and interesting than anything the LHC might say. So we'll be thinking about that in 50 years rather than any of the implications for particle physics that we might get out of accelerators. So thanks. I'll end with that.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, I'm afraid we don't have time for questions.
Sorry.
Because we had a number of them during the talk. And let us thank the speaker again. And this is the end, the last session during the conference. And before passing the microphone to Pierre Benitri for closing remarks, allow me to use this opportunity to thank, on behalf of participants of the meeting, the guests of the Perimeter Institute, to thank the organizers for the marvelous, absolutely perfect organization of this workshop and the interesting program, and to wish this young institution many more years of productive research along the lines of this meeting and beyond. Okay.
Thank you.